From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grolot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Welcome to Worldviews. Today, Joshua Landis and I focus on aggression in the eastern part of Ukraine, as well as the historical importance of Ukraine in Russian history and the impact of today's tensions on the Russian economy. We'll also discuss how the war in Syria has affected the country's ancient history and cultural heritage.
Great Crusader castles, Krak the Chevalier, has been bombed by both sides because rebels took up and made it a stronghold. The government bombed it. It makes you want to cry.
And later, a conversation with Israeli scholar Zaki Shalom. He says the Arab Spring has shifted focus away from the Middle East's more long-standing discord.
If you look at this, 3 years of rebuilding in the Arab world, there has never been a case where they burned an American flag or an Israeli flag. They don't care about the conflict with Israel.
But first, this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grolot. Joshua Landis, it's just you and me this week. And of course, Ukraine and Russia all over the front pages, this situation becoming more and more tense. Pro-Russian militants are making their incursions into eastern Ukraine, occupying now many buildings and seizing government properties in eastern Ukraine. Ukrainian military is obviously having a very difficult time responding. They don't seem to have the heart to respond in one way, but they also seem to just be weak, obviously, in this situation. Although they have killed now a couple of pro-Russian protesters. So things really seem to be going down a very difficult path still, but this has its roots in a lot of history. So tell us a little bit about that, Joshua, as a historian. Why is this going on here, and why is this so important to Russia?
Well, the Ukrainians, as you say, the Ukrainians have got themselves into a real pickle here. If they do use military force, they may provoke a Russian counterattack. If they don't, they lose the eastern provinces. And, you know, the phrase that Putin used that struck me is he said, this is new Russia, referring to eastern Ukraine. Kharkiv, Luhansk, Donetsk, Odessa were not part of Ukraine in Tsarist times. They were transferred in 1920. Why, he said? God knows. So he clearly has his eye on all of those eastern provinces, and he's going to get them one way or another, if not through very extreme autonomy, then he's going to take them militarily. And what can the West do about it? Not very much. But this goes back to Peter the Great. At the beginning of the 1700s, took big hunks of Ukraine, divided it up with Poland. Catherine the Great, who came later in the 1700s, took the Crimea from the Crimean Tatars in the Ottoman Empire and took other parts and swallowed up the rest of Poland. Poland was divided between Germany, Austro-Hungary, the Habsburg Empire, and Russia. So the rest of Ukraine that was Polish got sucked into the Russian Empire. That's the way it endured, give or take little bits here and there, until the 1920s, until the end of the First World War. Paris Peace Conference created Ukraine. Ukraine got sucked up again in the Second World War and spit out again. And now, with Russia back, Putin strong, Ukraine weak, we don't know what's going to happen. We just saw Yugoslavia get chopped into seven countries, Czechoslovakia split into two. This could mean a separation of Ukraine between Russians and Ukrainians. We'll have to see.
So obviously the geopolitics of today has significant roots in its historical past.
300 years of Russian rule. It's you know, for Americans, it's hard to grasp the meaning of this. And we have to perhaps compare it with Latin America, where with interventions in Latin America, whenever a foreign power has gotten too close to Latin America, we say, keep out. This is our zone. And in a sense, Russia is saying that about Ukraine. Now, where that line will be drawn, hard to know.
Reestablishing that buffer zone, perhaps. But nonetheless, there are consequences here. I mean, it's not like Russia can – maybe not military consequences. I mean, that will be seen, I suppose, if there will be military consequences for Russia. But certainly economic consequences have already begun. Inflation on the rise, growth declining, the ruble, their currency, their stock market, everything declining, unstable, billions of dollars of capital leaving Russia, people not wanting to invest in Russia right now, Russians themselves saying this is too unstable. Prices are on the rise, wages declining, consumer confidence, public confidence is declining in the economy. But yet we have this significant support for what Putin is doing. He's got the highest popularity ratings and approval ratings of all time right now. So that historical connection seems to be very real, but there is a disconnect between that historical connection and their actual economic, physical well-being today.
I guess it really depends whether he can make this grab and get away with it. If he can, the economy will come bouncing back probably. If he doesn't, if it embroils him into a longer situation, it could lead to a real recession in Russia, and we don't know how that
will play out. They're on the brink of a recession right now. Well, let's turn to Syria, back to your part of the world, Joshua. But let's look at Syria from a little different perspective. We're starting to see some news coming out about the cultural impact of the war in Syria. And we've been talking for some time about the devastation of the country, obviously life and death, you know, all of the horrible things that are going on in Syria. Hundreds of thousands of people dead, many gone and fled to other countries. But the conflict today doesn't have just an impact on the people in the future of Syria, but again, that historical connection, their ruins, their ancient past. Syria was this crossroads where the Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, all, you know, these Islamic cultures kind of all came together and crossed paths and left these amazing sites behind. And now we're starting to wonder, are these sites going to make it? Tourism is down. They're not being well protected. The Syrian military is using these sites as military outposts. I mean, this is devastating too, is it not?
It is. And the historical underpinnings of Syria have been devastated through this war. We just yesterday, Maalula, a Christian Aramaic town, one of the last three towns where Aramaic, the language of Jesus Christ, is still spoken today, was retaken by the Syrian government after falling to the hands of Islamic forces. The result is the town has been emptied out. Two of the great monasteries that had been alive there since the 6th century in ruins, big holes through their domes and so forth. But throughout Syria, we've seen the same in many of the Roman ruins, and Syria is the home of some great Roman ruins. The mosaics have all been dug up. We've seen aerial photos of these places, and grave robbers and others have dug down all over the place looking for things. And this is in many sites, war. The souks of Aleppo completely destroyed. And so we've seen this all throughout the town. Many of the big sites along Euphrates from 4,000 years ago have been completely dug up.
Well, museums are even being looted. They have 30-some-odd museums in Syria. Most of them all are closed now, but at least three of them have been looted. As you said, grave diggers, but, you know, tomb raiders, basically. You know, lots of illegal digs and theft of Syria's cultural artifacts are now starting to be found on
all over. This is what happened in Iraq, but it's going on a larger scale in Syria because there is no authority here. And it's devastating. It's devastating for the whole Middle East. But Syria was one of the jewels of the crown of the Middle East, with great souks, great crusader castles, the most beautiful crusader castle, Crac de Chevalier, undisturbed, has been bombed by both sides because rebels took up and made it a stronghold. The government bombed it. It makes you want to cry. And I guess it's the price of war.
Definitely the price of war. Well, thank you so much, Joshua Landis, as always, for your historical insight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you have a question or a comment for Joshua or me, let us know on our website, kgou.org. You can also send us a tweet at worldviewskgou or at Suzette Gralat and at Joshua_Landis. Coming up, I'll talk with Zaki Shalom from the Institute for National Security Studies and Ben-Gurion University. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Today, I'm joined by Zaki Shalom from the Institute for National Security Studies and the Ben-Gurion Research Institute. He's written several biographies of the Institute's namesake, Israel's first Prime Minister, David Ben-Gurion. He also studies diplomacy, Israel's nuclear option, and the country's relationship with the United States. Dr. Zaki Shalom, welcome to Worldviews.
Welcome. Thank you.
So you're an expert on Israel's defense policy, but I'd like to maybe go back a little bit and start with the work that you've done on the historical relationship between the United States and Israel. Can you give us a little bit of context about that relationship? And in particular, you've written a lot about Nixon's role, for example, in the Middle East and how that changed U.S.-Israeli relations. So tell us a little bit about that.
You're right. I think that basically the United States has been supporting Israel since its establishment in 1948. I think there were two or three reasons for that. First of all, the memory of the Holocaust. Over 6 million people were killed. And the United States felt that the Jews have their right to their state of their own. And since we live in not in a very friendly neighborhood with millions of Arabs who don't like our existence there, the United States felt it's her duty to ensure that we will survive as the only Jewish state in the world. And that's why the United States has basically supported us economically, militarily, and politically throughout the years. Of course, there were ups and downs, there were controversies, our agreements, but basically the United States is our best ally in the world. The other thing that I think that connects us and the United States is the fact that we are both democracies. In a world in which the democracies are shrinking and we see the radical Islamic groups that threaten both us and the United States, and I think the United States has great appreciation for our efforts, and I think it's America supports us, but I don't want to say that this is a kind of charity that's given to us, because we feel that it's kind of mutual relationship, and we feel that we respond favorably to the United States, and we hope this kind of relation will go on for many years ahead.
Well, so a mutually beneficial relationship historically
exactly.
Between the two. But what are the consequences of that relationship? I mean, are there any consequences in terms of the greater relationship with the region, Israel's relations with its neighbors, and you know, the United States' role as an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli interaction and relationship?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it has brought at least two nations in the Arab world to conclude peace with Israel, because when you know that Israel is supported by a great power of the United States, and there is no possibility of wiping out the Jewish state from the map, because the United States will not let it be done. So then the only conclusion which the Arabs came to is that it's better to live with the states and to try to benefit from it rather than to fight it for years for nothing. And I think this brought both Egypt and Jordan to conclude peace with Israel. And we hope that this will lead other Arab states to go on the same path.
My guest is Zaki Shalom from the Institute for National Security Studies and the Ben-Gurion Research Institute. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Gorlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking with Israel scholar Zaki Shalom. When we left off, he described how both Egypt and Jordan decided it was better to live with a Jewish state than have a longstanding conflict with Israel. Well, so let's shift a little bit. You've done some work on Israelis' nuclear forces. Now, you know, Israel isn't terribly transparent about the types and kinds and numbers of nuclear forces that they have. We're fairly certain that they do, but we, you know, it's a bit opaque. But so tell me what it is you can tell me about Israelis' nuclear forces and how that has an impact. To what degree does that have an impact on nuclear ambitions in the region, right? So for Iran, for example, and before that, perhaps years ago, Iraq, that had perhaps ambitions for at least nuclear power, if not nuclear capability.
Well, Israel has, we call it the nuclear option. We don't talk about nuclear ability. We talk about nuclear option, because what is important is not what Israel has or hasn't. It's the important thing is that other things that we have it. Okay, once you think that we have it, we don't care if we have it or we don't have it. And the state in the region believe that we have a very powerful nuclear capability. Iran knows it, Syria knows it, and in my view, this is a kind. This is a one factor of the stability, relative stability in the Middle East, because states like Egypt and Syria and Iran are treating us. First of all, Egypt has colonial peace with Israel because it knows, as I said before, that we have good ally as the United States, and because there's no chance for them to destroy us, because if God forbid this will happen, we will be able to destroy them back, okay? So they are scared of our retaliation abilities, of our deterrence abilities, and I think this has been a positive factor in the Middle East, basically. As I said, we don't declare anything about it. We keep it secret, we don't deny it, and we do not acknowledge that we have it. But what is important is that the other thing that we have it, and this is the very strategic, important factor in the Middle East.
But the lack of transparency, or the fact that some believe, and you want people to believe, that you have the capability or an option, a nuclear option, that this promotes nuclear proliferation, that this promotes the desire of an Iran, let's say, to have a nuclear weapon.
No,
is this not the case?
I don't think that Iran went on a nuclear project because of Israel. I think people are aware of the fact that Israel is a special case, a very unique case. We are a nation that has lost one-third of its people in the Holocaust, and we are the only Jewish nation in the world. And we have to defend ourselves because we have suffered bravely from the hatred of Jews in Europe. And we take threats very seriously, because when Hitler raised up to power, people said, you don't have to worry for him, he's just joking, he's not serious about it. And in fact, we lost 6 million of our people. We don't take any chance anymore. So I think the United States, and I think also the Arab countries, know that Israel is a special case. Israel is a reliable state, a responsible state. It will not use nuclear weapon just for fun. It will use, God forbid, only if it's under really threat to its very existence. And I don't think that this was a factor in leading up any other state in the area to acquire nuclear capabilities.
But of course, if you listen to the rhetoric, at least coming out of a country like Iran, they are saying, well, Israel has nuclear weapons. There are nuclear weapons all around us. We're a big state. We have a long history. So why shouldn't they be allowed to have those nuclear weapons?
Well, Iran's problem is because there is a combination between having a capability and being ruled by a very, very fanatic Islamic regime. If it was like, you know, nobody made a big deal about India having nuclear capabilities, okay? Because everybody knows that India is a reliable state, a reliable government. But when you have this combination of nuclear capability with such a regime that declares openly that it's going to wipe out the Jews from the map, okay, then this is causing the danger in the region. That's why not only Israel but the United States and the whole world is worried about Iran having a nuclear capability.
So it's not so much that Iran has the capability, it's this particular regime. It's because the spread of nuclear weapons isn't as concerning as it is who you know, the regime that has
it. Of course.
Pakistan, right? If we live with a Pakistani regime, nuclear regime,
Pakistan was
reliable, we can't live with an Israeli
was
one,
reliable
or an Iranian
regime
one.
When they acquired the nuclear capability. Now it's not the case. But if Iran was still ruled by the Shah, I think the attitude would have been different, obviously. The question is, what kind of regime is holding this kind of very, very dangerous weapons?
Well, so then moving forward, I mean, the Middle East right now is in a significant amount of turmoil. Interestingly enough, Israel is actually kind of the beacon of stability in the region. So what do you think about the future of the region? And what is Israel trying to do to promote peace and stability, if anything at all, and throughout the Middle Eastern region?
Well, what is going on in the Middle East is the upheaval of the population. People are now trying to get their own needs. I think this is basically a very positive development, by the way, because it's the first time that the people in the Arab states say we want the government to take care of our own needs. We don't want you to care about the Palestinian or the Syrian or any other. We want you to give us employment, education, health, and anything that is that the other people in the world have. You know, this technological revolution in the world with the internet and the TV has made it possible for young people in Egypt and in Syria and other places to see how young people live in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, in Paris or in London, and say, why don't we live in the same manner? What's wrong with us? If you look at this, 3 years of rebellion in the Arab world, there has never been a case where they burned an American flag or an Israeli flag. They don't care about the conflict with Israel. They care about their own needs. And I think that basically this is a very positive development, because once they will put their social economic needs in first priority, they will be more inclined to have good relation with Israel, because they know they can benefit from our abilities, technology abilities, our knowledge, and so on.
So it's not the Arab-Israeli conflict that's really characterizing the entire conflict throughout the Middle East. It's something much bigger than that. And so solving the Arab-Israeli conflict isn't going to bring stability to
it. It will have a good day. We really want it to be solved. But as I said, the upheaval now in the Arab world is not has not been caused by the Arab-Israeli conflict. The cry of the people is for the government is to stop, to put emphasis on conflict, on acquiring arms. They want the government to take care of their social and economic needs. They want to live like any other youngster in the world. And I think that's basically, as I said, this is a very positive development.
So it's about development, ultimately. Well, thank you, Dr. Shalom, for being with us
welcome.
Today to provide your perspective on this important topic. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Zaki Shalom, a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies and Ben-Gurion University. We have more information on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a collaborative partnership with the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Nick Aguilera researches these interviews and publishes our content on the web. And Brian Hardzinski produces the show. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gorlott.